Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Images of the tsunami's devastation around the Indian Ocean, mile after mile of life wiped away, bodies piled in temple courtyards, have conveyed the awesome scale of that disaster to the world. Now, as American survivors of the tsunami return home, they are sharing their more intimate stories. Tonight, we'll hear them. We'll hear from divers who survived the tsunami deep beneath its fury and surfaced to devastation, from a couple who had climbed a high ridge to pray and saw the beach below swept away, from survivors who just ran, who hung on, who got lucky, who lived. Tonight on Point, tsunami survivors' stories, what they witnessed, and what they are thinking now. But first, we begin tonight in Jakarta, Indonesia, where Simon Elegant, longtime Southeast Asia correspondent for Time magazine, has been following the aftermath of the tsunami. He's just returned from Banda Aceh and the North Sumatran coast, ground zero of the tsunami's impact. I asked him where the disaster and massive relief effort stand now.
I think we stand sort of balanced in between where people are just beginning to come out of the shock and the numbness of the initial stages, and the relief operation is really getting into gear. I've been speaking to people, for example, from Médecins Sans Frontières. You know, they're finally getting their operations. Really, they feel they had to take a lot of measures to cut out bottlenecks. I think in the case of the relief operation, it's really happening. One of the big things we're waiting for right now is sort of waiting for a shoe to drop or a sword, depending on how you look at it, is to see whether there's an outbreak of disease in the camps, both here and elsewhere. Everybody's dreading cholera, a big dysentery attack, something like that, typhoid, a waterborne virus or bacteria that could really devastate people. The UN have estimated that it could quickly cause, they say, almost as many deaths as the original tsunami if it gets out of control. The longer the relief operation goes on, the less likely that is to happen. So we're just kind of balanced on an edge between the two. I think another week and we'd be in a much better position, but we're still, it's still dangerous days for a great many. I mean, we're talking about possible casualties of another 100,000, according to the WHO.
An additional 100,000. Simon, you've been in Banda Aceh in Sumatra, where some of the most severe destruction was. You say people are just coming out of the shock. Paint a picture for us, if you can, of the state of mind of people in this first 2 weeks since the tsunami hit and the evidence that they're now rounding a corner.
There are different stages. There's still plenty of people who are in the remoter areas who are still being accessed. Or they've just discovered, for example, one village with another 4,500 bodies that they had knew nothing about. The Indonesian estimates are so out of whack at the moment that two ministries came out today and gave estimates of the number of dead that were 25,000 apart. So obviously there's still a long way to go for some people in the remoter areas. I'm talking about people who are more accessible in Banda Aceh or some of the bigger towns. They're getting a lot of overflights from Singapore from the aircraft carrier that's anchored 7 kilometers offshore.
Yes.
Those people are just beginning to get some semblance back of their life. They're getting clean water again. When I was first there, they were literally just stumbling around in a daze. Some of the people I spoke to couldn't say nothing but repeat the names of the relatives they were looking for or the relatives they'd lost. Now they're beginning to address more mundane concerns about life, start thinking maybe a little bit about the future.
We've seen the pictures of what appears to be mile after mile of formerly settled areas where practically everything is washed away. What are Indonesian officials saying? Do they intend to rebuild all of this, or will some of these communities simply vanish and be gone?
Well, I think a lot of the people in those communities, the ones that were really blasted, are gone. As far as the cities are concerned, they are talking about rebuilding, yes. The villages, I think the people have just disappeared pretty much, a lot of them. But also, while they're talking of rebuilding in the city of Banda Aceh, for example, I don't think the Indonesian authorities have really thought in terms of reconstruction. They're still very much trying to keep people alive and keep them from getting disease and trying to get things organized.
We know there's been a global outpouring of money and material. What's your sense of the effectiveness of the relief effort in the areas that you've seen to this point?
Maybe I started out with low expectations because I've seen other disaster situations in Indonesia, and I have to say under a different president, several different presidents here, if there isn't strong direction from the top, it can be horrifyingly badly organized with people literally starving to death, or in other situations in which they've had riots and so on, you know, refugees trampling each other to death by the hundreds, and extortion of refugees by the military and the police quite often, gun battles I've seen between the military and the police who wanted to extort money from the refugees. So my expectations were a bit low, and I've been impressed in many ways. I think that some of his experiences in the army has helped the president here to address a logistical problem like this. He's taken some decisive steps. He's ordered his ministers, a couple of ministers responsible, to go and sit in Bandar Aceh and not come back, basically. He's taken some pretty good steps. And also, co-joined with that, the effort from the outside world, as you say, has been amazing, both on the level of the NGOs and, say, the U.S. reaction, you know, bringing in the aircraft carrier and the battle group, which has made a huge difference. Singaporeans have brought in landing craft and aircraft carrier, Australian troops on the ground. So a combination of a, I think, a surprisingly effective Indonesian response and a phenomenal response from around the world is working much better than I expected anyway.
And among Indonesians, in the media there, in conversations that you're privy to, how do they see the way that the world has come to their aid? Are they satisfied?
Yes. I think the simple answer is yes. I mean, I think a lot of them are quite stunned by it. There was even a letter in one of the newspapers, the big dailies here, that where somebody wrote in and said there's a local group that have been blamed for the Bali bombings you probably heard about called Jemaah Islamiyah.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Indonesians aren't entirely convinced that these guys are really terrorists. And there was a letter saying, you know, why is the United States being so prominent? Why is the West being so prominent in helping us? And where is Jemaah Islamiyah? Why aren't they in Aceh helping to solve the situation? So I think there's a lot of prejudice to get over, and it is being got over. On the other hand, I expect in a few weeks, particularly up in Aceh, where, as you know, there's been a major campaign for independence. 12,000 people have lost their lives in the last couple of decades.
Yes.
It's been under military law with no foreigners allowed for the last year and a half. I think the military will probably, to some extent, other elements in society will come to resent so many soldiers, foreign soldiers on their soil. I think that's probably going to be a problem in a few weeks. Right now, though, there is sort of in the first blush, the first honeymoon stage, where a lot of Indonesians very grateful and somewhat surprised, too, at the overwhelming sympathy and the money that's pouring in around from around the world.
And what about the U.S. presence in particular, led by the U.S. military? How has that been received?
Well, you know, USAID have taken their names off some of the boxes, you know, the big flags and stuff like that. I think they're trying to be a little bit low-key, but one of our reporters, I just spoke to him, he's out in the aircraft carrier, and he said the pilots are telling him when they're coming back that both, they've flown into some villages where they're controlled by rebels, and they've flown into some that are controlled by the soldiers, and they're getting welcome from both of them, and very much so from, obviously, from the local people who are sort of astonished and amazed that these people are appearing to help them and very happy as well. So, as I say, I think right now we're still in the honeymoon stage. I think it will get much more complicated later.
Simon Elegant, you've been in Southeast Asia for a long time reporting, much predating this disaster. What's your sense just of Indonesia and how it will ultimately absorb this blow?
Very interesting question. It's, as you know, a sprawling, huge country over thousands of miles, 220 million people, the biggest Islamic country in the world, a very complex place. It is often actually ignored, Aceh, to some extent. I think in Jakarta, the slaughter that's going up there, a really vicious, vicious battle between the government and the rebels. Incredibly proud people up in Aceh, proud and God-fearing people, you could call them, who have been suffering appallingly, really, in the last 20 years from this war that shut the place down. I think one of the things that will happen in Indonesia, it seems to be happening, is that it really has been an outpouring of sympathy in the country for Acehese. Whereas before, they were really seen as supporting rebels, independents, people who wanted to get out of Indonesia, out of the nation. Now, maybe this will build some sympathy for that. And I think that, in turn, will create a greater sense of nationhood in a place that one of my a former colleague once, as he wrote the title of his book, which is probably the best book written about Indonesia, called The Nation in Waiting.
Mm.
In other words, the nation is still trying to find a true sense of itself because it's so huge and diverse.
And Simon, if I may, finally, it's a bit presumptuous, but I just wonder if you can share anything with us of how you're personally processing this. I know you've seen a lot in your career, and yet people who have seen
as much as Kofi Annan, Colin Powell, and many others are saying, this goes beyond it all. As a reporter, as a man, how are you absorbing what you're seeing?
It's difficult to process. It's difficult to come up with any kind of reasonable explanation. As I say, I've done a bit of reporting on the Archonese. I've spoken to a lot of refugees previously. You know, it's partly because we were shut out of there. I always wanted to get at that story and get it out to the world in a way, because it is a place of great suffering and great sorrow previous to this. But trying to process, A, the appalling scale of the destruction. I mean, you saw Kofi Annan was actually visibly shaken after he saw it for the first time. That's the way you feel. You just, honestly, it looks like a nuclear bomb has gone off. It's completely leveled. The sheer scale of the whole thing. And then every single person you talk to had lost family members, and many of them in many cases. The question that keeps beating your brain is why, and there's no explanation, there's no closure for you at all. It's just, you almost do expect to see an angry God somewhere, but these are certainly not people who provoked anybody. They've been suffering for a long time, so I do find it very difficult to process, actually.
Impossible to find the why. Simon Elegant, you're very generous with your time. We appreciate your reporting, and we're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Simon Elegant is Southeast Asia correspondent for Time magazine. He spoke with me from Jakarta. We're reaching out tonight to hear American survivor stories from the great Indian Ocean tsunami. Of course, the toughest survivor stories are those of the now homeless and vulnerable in 11 nations around the Indian Ocean. You can find contacts for relief agencies helping them at our website, onpointradio.org. But there were many Americans on those coastlines, too, on the morning of December 26th. Karen Grosskreutz, a 27-year-old from Whitewater, Wisconsin, was scuba diving that morning off the shore of an island in southern Thailand. She survived to do relief work in a Bangkok phone bank and has now gone south again to Phuket to help with the relief effort. I asked her what it was like when the tsunami hit.
I actually didn't see it at all. I was underwater when it happened. I was scuba diving off of Kopi Phi. And so I felt it more than I saw it. And the way the waves came around the island, the current came really strong in one direction, and we turned around to go with them. They also came really strong in the other direction, and my buddy and I got caught in the current and thrown around, first almost to the surface, but not quite, then sucked back down. We struggled to get up for probably about a minute, and then we were able to surface. The current was still really strong, but we were able to get back on the boat. And we still had no idea what was going on, except that things were really strange. So we were one of the few dive boats to go back to the island right away. So when we went back, we were met with like a stream of debris coming towards us. First, it was just objects in the water. It was like, oh, look, it's a spare fin. It's a gas tank. Did a boat sink? What happened? As we got closer, we saw more and more things coming out. We still couldn't make out the shore, but we started to see bodies in the water. And then we started to see collapsed buildings.
And before long, you knew, like the world eventually knew, what had happened there. Describe the extent of the damage you've seen, Karen.
On Kopi Phi, where I was, it was just erased. The north half of the island was just erased.
Erased?
And, yeah, just only the palm trees are left. A few foundations of concrete on the ground.
And what was there before the waves came?
There were bungalows everywhere. There were little shops everywhere. Resorts, hotels, restaurants, everything. I couldn't even find the guest house where we'd been staying. There's nothing.
Just gone?
Gone, yeah.
What has it been like for you emotionally to look out on all that destruction?
The first couple nights I was really paranoid and woke up for no reason in the middle of the night. Just flip on the light and I start packing those few things that we had left. Now, having been in Bangkok, where I've been safe, it's much easier. The hardest thing to do was to leave and then find out that there were still so many people that needed help immediately. I'm glad to be back down here now to hopefully still be of some help, but the week that I've been gone has been crucial to everyone here, and it's hard to have missed it.
Your survival sounds almost like a miracle, to have been underwater as the tsunami washed over. You must run that movie through your mind and think about all the possibilities, all the ways in which you might have been on that shore, in which you might have been one of those victims.
Not a day goes by when someone doesn't remind me how lucky I was. No, neither am I, you know.
Karen Grosskreutz, back in Phuket now after miraculously surviving the tsunami. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Karen Grosskreutz is a 27-year-old native of Whitewater, Wisconsin. She spoke with me from Phuket, Thailand. We'll hear more tsunami survivor stories after the break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we're hearing the stories of American survivors of the Indian Ocean tsunami. Their stories of devastation and hope. Caroline Malatesta is a 25-year-old accountant from Mountain Brook, Alabama, who was on Thailand's Phi Phi Island with her husband JT on the morning of December 26th. She believes an urge to pray saved them both. I asked her what brought them to Southeast Asia.
My husband and I were on a three-month trip celebrating him graduating law school to Nepal, India, and then all around Southeast Asia. And this was the last day of that trip. We were finishing up in Thailand trying to get some rest before you started a new job.
So on the morning of December 26th, exactly where were you?
We were down on the beach in the morning, and then my husband wanted to go up to the viewpoint to read his Bible, and I just wanted to see the views. And so we went up about 30 minutes before the first wave came to the viewpoint, which is the highest point on the island.
And there you were on the last day of your backpacking trip, him to take a spiritual moment and you to be with him there. And what did you see?
Well, first we saw the bay draining, and we thought it was low tide at first, and we thought it was very unusual. But then we realized that it wasn't low tide because coral reefs were being exposed and, you know, the floor of the bay was being exposed. It was just like a bathtub draining. And then we saw what appeared to be a small wave coming in. And we realized it wasn't a small wave when it started picking up boats as if they were just feathers and just taking them inland, not stopping at all, you know, taking everything with it.
From where you were, could you see the people on the beach? Could you see the guest houses?
We did. We could, and we could see a bunch of people on the beach. I guess everybody started realizing at once and screaming and everything, and it's just like everyone on the beach picked up and just started sprinting away from it.
Did you see people swept up in the wave?
Yes, we did.
You know, we've talked with people who were underwater scuba diving, now you who are up on a mountain away from it. But to be on the beach at that moment, can you describe what it was like before the destruction hit?
Before the destruction, it was beautiful. It was one of the most beautiful days yet. It was peaceful. Never would have expected something like that to come.
And what kind of buildings, what kind of development was there? What island was it again?
It was Phi Phi Island in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mainly bungalows. It's not a bunch of resorts, you know, that are well built and that can withstand that kind of wave.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of those type of resorts there, and they were wrecked but not totally destroyed.
Mm.
But it was mainly bungalows and structures like that.
When did you and your husband decide to come down from the high point where you'd been when the wave hit?
Everyone at the top of the mountain, there were about 10 of us, were a bit confused by what happened. We're all asking each other, if you know, do you know what happened? Do you know what happened? And then we saw another wave come and go, and then I think somebody picked up on what it was and what had happened, and so we start going down the mountain to try to help people.
What did you say on the way down the mountain? Did you have any idea at that point the magnitude of what was underway here?
No, not at all. Still kind of in shock. Don't really know what happened. I mean, have an idea, but still kind of in shock.
And when you reached the level ground, reached the beach?
That's when it got bad, because that's when people were having to be pulled out of the rubble, I guess. And that's when there were a lot of hurt people that we had to try to help.
We've all seen the photographs now of unbelievable destruction and unbelievable number of wounded and dead. Did you have to witness that firsthand, or was it less severe where you were, Caroline?
We were there. Yeah, we did.
And how many days later was it that you were headed back to Alabama?
We were fortunate to get on a ferry after about a day and a half of being on the island. So we only spent one night there.
So now you and your husband are back. An unbelievable end to a three-month backpacking trip. You're back in the States, far from all that. How are you processing what happened and what you saw sitting back home?
I mean, sometimes are harder than others. It's hardest, you know, when you turn out the lights to go to bed at night and it's just you and your thoughts. But being surrounded by our friends and our family and having so many people praying for us is helping us a lot. But it's going to be a slow process.
And
but we're very fortunate.
And how do you understand that fortune, Caroline? How do you make sense of the fact that so many people were swept away, so many were killed, you survived?
To us, it's a miracle from God, but at the same time, we do ask the questions like, why us, and why do we still have each other when so many families were split up, and questions like that that we're going to have to deal with. But we do believe it was a miracle from God.
Caroline Malatesta, we're glad you survived, and we appreciate your telling us of your experience that day on Phi Phi Island in Thailand. Thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Caroline Malatesta is a 25-year-old accountant from Mountain Brook, Alabama. You can see photos she and her husband took of the tsunami on our website at onpointradio.org. David Rucker, a 34-year-old from Berkeley, California, was taking a three-week vacation in Southeast Asia with his girlfriend and business partner, Sandy Thompson, over the holidays. I asked where they were when the tsunami hit.
On a small island in Thailand, just north of Phuket. We were about 20 miles north of that on the same coast.
And what were you doing on that morning, Sandy?
We were swimming on the beach. We had gotten up that morning, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful day, and the water was like glass, and that was about at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. We're coming up on 10:30 a.m. What was the first sign that you had that something odd was going on, David?
In the background, maybe a kilometer or two offshore, we could see a white line on the horizon. You know, much bigger than something that would be caused by the wake of a boat, and it stretched across the entire horizon. It came closer and closer and got bigger and bigger, and at one point, in fact, it actually swallowed a small island that was offshore. We started to get a little nervous at that point.
And then, Sandy, you've described a sound, a noise.
Yes, a very frightening sound. It sounded like many jets at one time as the water was getting close. It was coming at such high speed.
And visually, David, what did you see? It's been hard for us to get a sense. We get glimpses of video from here and there. Sometimes it looks like a wall of water, sometimes just like a great swell. What exactly did you see in the water?
You know, at a distance, we don't have experience with this sort of thing. We have no frame of reference. So from a kilometer distance, it looks like a big white wall of churning water. The idea that it's 40 feet high doesn't really occur to you when it's a kilometer out. As it gets closer, it starts to occur to you that this is very dangerous. We saw this wall of water in perspective with some boats as they were trying to escape.
Hmm.
And we saw the boats enveloped by this wall of water.
Sandy, when did you begin to feel really acute fear or even panic? When did your body and mind tell you, let's go?
I had gotten out of the water early on and encouraged Dave to get out of the water as well. And we were watching this wave come towards us with the entire resort, and we were just bewildered. We had never seen anything like it before. When the water started to recede, that's when we sort of clued in that this wasn't an ordinary happening.
Mm.
But for some reason, we still all stood there and videotaped it. The owner of the resort had gotten a call from Phuket. It hit there first, and he had just gotten the information that it had completely wiped out Phuket and that it was a tsunami. And so he started screaming in Thai, run for your lives. We couldn't understand what he was saying, but we got the gist of it. And all the Thai people started to run, and we ran after them. And it was the most frightening thing I have ever experienced and hopefully ever will.
How exactly did you survive the hit of the wave, Sandy?
Well, we ran as fast as we could, and Dave went one way and I went the other. We split up, and he went right into a building, and I didn't think that was a good idea, and I didn't even have time to say, Dave, I don't think that's a good idea. I just cut left and ran across a field.
But you must have hung on to something.
The only thing that was there that was above ground was a flatbed truck, so I ran towards that, and I didn't even have time to jump on it. I just held my arms out to people who were already on it, and they grabbed me and flung me on just in time, and that's when the water hit. So I was on the truck, and then the truck floated.
The truck floated?
It floated, yes. The entire resort was underwater.
But a flatbed truck floated, and you survived standing upon it. David, how about you? You went into a building. What happened there?
I went into a building, and I looked around, and there was no place to go inside that building, so I kept running until I got to one of the last buildings in line in the resort. And it was a concrete structure about one story. I got up on a 2-foot concrete pad, and there was a 2-foot table.
Yeah.
So I got up on those, and I started trying to get up into the rafters. But I had to come down again because a German tourist, an elderly woman, came in, and she was very frightened, and she didn't know where to go, and she, I thought, was standing in perhaps just exactly the wrong place.
So what did you and she do when the water hit?
Well, I got her up on the table, and we essentially just held on to each other, and we held on to a concrete column. The building itself broke the wavefront. So we were kind of in an eddy. So although the water got to about her chest height, we weren't carried away with the current. There were people on either side of the building being carried away.
You both end up surviving almost against the odds. Sandy, you must have followed the news very closely since you got back to the States. What are you left thinking?
I'm thinking that we're blessed and very, very lucky. I do find it hard to watch the news coverage because it does bring back a lot of horrible things. What I really, really think is important is that people help the people who are still suffering. It was very hard for me to come back to my warm house with my blankets and food and as much water as I want to drink when we left so many people behind that are still suffering.
David, I guess I want to ask if your sense of nature has changed since you witnessed this.
It's funny, I was just reflecting on that today. I'm a water person, and I really like going out into the water and going diving and snorkeling and just being on the beach. But I have to admit, I wonder if this sense of apprehension is ever going to go away. You know, I don't look at it the same way as this beautiful and passive landscape. It can occasionally do some amazing things.
David Rucker, Sandy Thompson, we're glad you survived, and we appreciate you sharing your story. And, Sandy, we hear you loud and clear, the call for support of the people still there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Rucker and Sandy Thompson spoke with me from Berkeley, California. Across the Indian Ocean, that terrible morning, Bill Rechtenwald, a 63-year-old journalism teacher at Southern Illinois University, was near the end of his third trip to Sri Lanka. I asked Bill what had taken him to Sri Lanka.
2 years ago, Southern Illinois University at Carbondale had a grant from the State Department to do training of journalists there, and I spent 4 days there, and I just really liked it. The people were lovely. The country was interesting, inexpensive. I went back last year for a couple of weeks, and I've developed a group of friends there who are Sri Lankan, and went back again this year for vacation, went up, visited the high country and the center parts of the ancient cities, and I was spending the last 4 days down on the south beaches, world-class beaches, absolutely gorgeous.
It is a beautiful country, and you had a good helping of it, and then came the morning of December 26th. Where were you, Bill?
I was at the Hotel Club Lanka, which is a little two-star hotel on the beach, and I'd come down to have breakfast outside. I just had a little pineapple and coffee, and there was a yell from the beach, and I looked over at the ocean and saw a splash, and then I saw what occurred to me was a rogue wave. A couple of waves came in actually onto the grounds of the hotel, and I took my camera out and took a couple of pictures, and within about 15 seconds, my feet were wet, but I still did not compute that I was in a danger. I jumped up on a wall about 3 feet. I figured, well, I'll be safe from anything here. And then all hell broke loose. One wave after another, I was holding onto a vertical concrete pillar. Probably three quick, very quick successive waves came and hit me. I could hear glass breaking. I was holding on to this pillar. I was under. My glasses were being knocked off. I took one hand off the pillar to push the glasses on. Water started to recede. It broke me loose from the pillar, and I was floating around, and people were yelling at me from the second floor balcony, and they already had water lapping at their feet, but they're screaming, "Swim over to us, swim over to us." And I looked, and I saw there was just a swirling water. Then I saw the parking lot. Cars were upside down, bouncing into each other. The walls of the hotel office were collapsing. The fences around the hotel were big, tall stone. The fences were collapsing. And I saw some rope in the water. And I reached and I grabbed the rope, and I saw that it was tied onto another pillar, and I was able to pull myself into the other pillar, and there was another guy, a British merchant marine officer, retired there and hanging on. And I said, "How long does this go on?" And he just said, "Hang on." And probably in a minute and a half, the water receded down. We could get down on the ground. The whole event with the water took less than 5 minutes. And of course, we began to see what our own condition was and start looking for missing people.
And there were deaths right there at the hotel.
There were two people. One Sri Lankan guest in the first floor room was drowned. We tried to resuscitate him, but he was dead. The kitchen collapsed, and concrete had fallen on a kitchen worker, and he was also dead.
Bill, at what point did you have any idea what this was about? What was happening?
Our immediate thought was we were looking for this little girl, a little 3.5-year-old girl named Esther. She was there with an extended family of British folks, and everybody was concerned that she was missing, a little blonde-haired doll. And we started to look for her. We couldn't find her. Nobody found her in the rooms. They finally asked us to evacuate the hotel because they were concerned of another wave. We got up the hill, got onto the lawn of a big house, took a little break there. They brought us tea. And about an hour later, they brought us a truck. We loaded up on the truck. Esther's father stayed to continue the search. We were driving up to a tea plantation about an hour away up into the mountains.
Was she ever found, Esther?
As we drove up the road, we were slowed as we passed the hospital, and it was a madhouse at the hospital. And all of a sudden, Esther's sister let out a scream, "It's Esther," and they're being carried by my waiter, who was still smiling.
Yeah.
Was little Esther, and he ran over with another young man from the hotel and handed her up on the truck. When the first waves came, Esther was up to her neck. They were terrified. They grabbed this little girl. They ran up the hill. They ran 4 miles to the hospital. A town there wasn't, there was a dry eye in the back of that truck.
I'm sure there wasn't. She lived, and thank God for it. Many, many others died, including maybe 10,000 in Galle, where you had just been the day before. Bill, our time is short, and the story is deep. How are you processing what you saw and what's happened in this tsunami?
Well, I'm relieved that I've also talked to some other of my Sri Lankan friends, including one this morning at length on the phone. I've seen a lot of things. I'm a retired newspaper reporter and used to cover murder and mayhem for the Chicago Tribune, but I've never seen anything like this. And I've never seen the kindness and caring come to me from strangers as I did from the Sri Lankan people. They're very special people, and I'm doing the very best that I can to do whatever I can to help them and encourage people to contribute to international relief.
Well, we're glad for that length of rope attached to a pillar that kept you alive, Bill Rechtenwald.
Yes, so am I.
Sure
so
you
time.
Are. Thank you very much for telling us your story.
Okay, my friend.
Bill Rechtenwald is a 63-year-old journalism teacher at Southern Illinois University. He spoke with me from Carbers Ridge, Illinois. After the break, the relief side of the story. A Harvard Business School student from Sri Lanka rallies to help victims of the tsunami. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've heard stories of American tsunami survivors tonight. Now, the story of a young Sri Lankan who heard the news in the United States and responded. Nayana Mawilmada is a 32-year-old Harvard Business School student from Sri Lanka. The tsunami came to him, as to most of the world, as a news story that was, at first, hard to understand.
Well, my wife woke me up, I think about 7 in the morning. Our son had got up. She just checked the internet and saw this article, and that's basically how I found out. And the first thing we did was try to frantically contact my wife's family because they actually live very close to the coast in Colombo.
Now, Colombo's just a bit up the west coast. It didn't take as much of the brunt of the tsunami as the south and eastern coasts of Sri Lanka. How was your wife's family?
Fortunately, they're fine. They had a little bit of flooding in their house, but nothing major. and they lost power. We were pretty relieved that we were actually able to get through.
But almost every family in Sri Lanka has relatives at some point in the family tree who were hit by this wave.
I would say almost anybody in Sri Lanka knows somebody that got killed. One of my cousins, for example, a guy I grew up with, his wife lost pretty much all her extended family, and they still haven't found the bodies.
You have poured yourself into fundraising, relief fundraising for Sri Lanka. How did that get going, Diana?
The first day or so after I found out this was happening, I was pretty much frozen. I was in a bit of shock. As soon as I found out my cousin's family was missing, that was pretty much the impetus that forced me to just say, look, I have to do something. And then I just started like this big email campaign through Harvard and got involved with a bunch of other people trying to raise funds.
Helpsl.org. How's it going? How's the response been?
That effort's really going well. We've positioned that as a conduit for aid to Sri Lanka. So, you know, it kind of matches people who want to give either money, clothes, food, or their time with organizations that are looking for donations, both local nonprofit type groups as well as international groups such as Red Cross and Oxfam.
Diana, I've spent some time in Sri Lanka. It's a beautiful country. In your hometown, you said you're from Kandy, more in the center of the country, up in hill country.
Yes.
That's a long way from the beaches, and many Americans have difficulty picturing exactly what these communities were like and the infrastructure that was so exposed to the tsunami. I wish you could describe for us, maybe along that east and southern coast, what the typical stretch of Sri Lankan coast is like.
There's two characteristics, depending on where you go. You know, a good chunk of it is really small fishing communities, which are decimated. Just south of Colombo, the stretch there for about 100, 150 miles is pretty much the tourist belt. Everything is studded with either tourist hotels or fishing villages. And just as a point of reference, I got a report saying about 70% of the Sri Lankan coastline was hit by the tsunami. About 70 to 80% of the fishing villages and the fishing boats are destroyed. There's one aspect of this, which is the human dimension. We've all seen the babies, you know, dead, the people dead, the mothers crying. That's one thing. But then to get these people back on their feet, the two industries that really kept these coastal areas alive are gone. The
tourism
and
fishing.
The tourism.
And if you would just describe the physical profile of most of those fishing villages, they are fragile. It doesn't take much to wash them away.
Sure. I mean, when you look at the poorer communities will not have solid concrete construction. A lot of these houses will be, a good portion of them will be wood, and maybe like little sections would be cement. So that's one of the reasons they're so easily washed away. Of course, even the big hotels got significant damage, but there's very few kind of solid concrete structures in these small fishing communities. They're pretty poor communities, especially when you go to the south. There aren't that many wealthy people down there.
You must have heard many stories in your efforts to aid in raising relief. Tell us, share with us, what have you heard about the day of destruction, about the aftermath?
What I did hear, which was very, very riveting to me, is my cousin's experience trying to find his relatives. As soon as they found out, they went down to this town called Hambantota, which is in the south. He was looking for his mother-in-law and all his in-laws, basically. And they found their vehicle. It was a van. It was smashed up. And they couldn't find any of the bodies. He said he and his brother looked through about 2,000 corpses, and at the end of the day, they just couldn't take it anymore. And that really, I mean, he basically started crying at that point, and it's really gripping to see. I mean, to imagine somebody pouring through 2,000 rotting corpses trying to find a family member, that's a pretty rough thing to go through. And, you know, his is probably not one of the worst cases.
But overwhelming even to imagine, and in that heat and with all the destruction around. Oh, Diana, Sri Lanka, of course, is a majority Buddhist country with a famous insurgency from the Tamil Hindus in the north. Is your family Buddhist?
I'm actually on the middle of this conflict. I'm Sinhalese Buddhist. My wife is Hindu.
Ah, so you've got both religions in one family.
Yes.
How do you see it at the spiritual level, these two communities dealing with this? Is there a path through the Buddhism that you know, the Hinduism that your wife knows, that helps explain this or deal with this?
I'm hard-pressed to say that there is something that says, well, this can be explained. I mean, in Buddhism, one of the few things that we're taught is, you know, the only thing that's certain in life is death. It's going to come, and not to worry about it. But having said that, most people are not going to find it that easy to deal with this situation.
No matter the religion. And what about that split between the Tamils and the Sinhalese? Do you see hope in the shared misery?
I would like to. I think at the beginning, there was a lot of hope. I mean, this is one of those things that's killed half as many people as have been killed in the ethnic war over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this tidal wave did not discriminate. So, yes, in mourning, the communities are definitely united. On the ground, there is a lot of aid going back and forth between Sinhalese and Tamil communities. And even on the U.S. side, some of the Sinhalese communities and the Tamil communities are working together, but not as much as I would like to see.
And what about in your efforts to raise relief? What's your assessment of how the world has responded? How's it left you feeling?
The world has responded pretty well. The question really to me is, when it comes time to rebuild and get these people back on their feet, really, will the money keep coming in or will there be enough? My father-in-law was volunteering at one of the camps in Trincomalee in the east, and he had gone even to the rebel-controlled areas, and he said aid flows are coming through. The question is, you know, is there going to be enough funding and is there going to be enough coordination between the rebels who control some parts of the coastline and the Sri Lankan government to actually get these people to live their lives again.
Back on their feet, all the complications of life come rolling back in.
But
the politics
on the ground, that's more and more starting to become an issue because with the aid comes control. So there's a bit of a power struggle on the ground as to who actually hands out this aid.
Well, let us hope that mercy and compassion come first, at least for a good while, to get people back on their feet. We appreciate the work that you've done and the time you spent with us tonight. Nayana Mawilmada, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nayana Mawilmada is a Harvard Business School student working with a group that runs the website helpsl.org to connect people with international aid agencies doing relief work in Sri Lanka. For survivor photos and links to many aid agencies where you can help, visit our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Do you approve of torture?
Absolutely not, Senator.
Do you condemn the interrogators' techniques at Abu Ghraib shown on the widely publicized photographs?
Let me say, Senator, that as a human being, I am sickened and outraged by those photos.
You were warned by Secretary Powell, and other top military leaders that ignoring our long-standing traditions and rules would lead to abuse and undermine military culture, and that is what has happened.
It's a problem that we must address. America's healthcare professionals should be focused on fighting illnesses, not on fighting lawsuits.
I have never seen anything like this, flying over Banda Aceh and seeing how the wave came ashore, pushing everything in its past, cars, ships, freighters overturned.
We have no goal. We think this is a long-term effort. There's no dollar figure set, but I can tell you this. Since this announcement and even before, private funds have been pouring in. The generosity and the heartbeat of the American people is being felt, I'll tell you, around the world. And I'm very, very pleased to be a part of this with President Clinton.
I seek to object to the electoral votes of the state of Ohio on the grounds that they were not, under all the circumstances known, regularly given. I have a signed objection, and I do have objection.
Has the senator signed the objection?
The senator has signed the objection.
Mahmoud Abbas, who's the leading candidate for Palestinian president, denounced the Israeli shelling and referred to Israel as the Zionist enemy. That's a term usually used by Islamic militants.
It gives a very bad reflection indeed to the members of the family that they themselves should not come out and say bravely that a member of my family has died of AIDS.
And there's a week, Alberto Gonzalez gets a grilling from the Senate Judiciary Committee during hearings into his nomination as Attorney General. President Bush uses his first visit of the year to push his plan to curb medical malpractice lawsuits. Colin Powell tours tsunami-devastated South Asia, while former presidents Bush and Clinton are tapped to head up private fundraising efforts for tsunami victims. Ohio Representative Stephanie Tubbs Jones and Senator Barbara Boxer formally object to the certification of Ohio's presidential election results. The objection just delays the inevitable, and President Bush's electoral victory is later made official. The leading candidate in the Palestinians' upcoming elections this Sunday, Mahmoud Abbas, calls Israel the Zionist enemy. And Nelson Mandela announces that his son has died from an AIDS-related illness. Jack Beatty, that last, Nelson Mandela, what a man, standing up once again and speaking truth.
Speaking truth, and of course he's been speaking truth on AIDS and on HIV for a good while, and speaking it to a government that didn't want to hear it. I mean, one of the extraordinary developments of recent years was the position of the South African government, that HIV did not cause AIDS, and therefore they rejected the kinds of medical interventions that can mitigate this and lengthen lifespans. And Mandela has been pressuring them for years, and they've begun to change, partly under his pressure. So, yes, a very, very brave man.
A lifelong truth teller, and just an incredible example, even at his age, even when the tragedy came right into his own house.
Yes, yes.
A tough week on the war front, Jack. The numbers are just enormous. What is it, 9 U.S. dead in the last 24 hours, a whole Bradley fighting vehicle hit by a roadside bomb, 7 in one blow, gone.
Yeah, 1,350 is now the total dead, 10,252 wounded as of this morning. And in this context, we hear from the Nelson Report, which is a daily political magazine, a report run out of Washington for corporate and government clients by a guy named Nelson. We hear from his sources that the president does not want to hear, quote, bad news on Iraq. All he wants to hear about, according to his sources, are the latest totals on school openings and good things like that. He does not want to hear the bad news.
Because he feels he's got to look past that to the bright future? Or what's the explanation? I mean, the news is everywhere. It's hard to avoid. Is he saying we've just got to grit our teeth, we've just got to grit and bear it through these elections till we reach some kind of greater stability there?
Well, the sources don't say, but it's frightening information. You know, we were talking a couple of weeks ago, in fact, talking about Time magazine naming Bush Person of the Year, and one of the reasons was his great political skill in, quote, reframing reality to suit his designs, a tremendous political skill. However, it's not a skill in governing, because reality is out there, and this says he's ignoring it.
Well, it was very tough to ignore this week. I have to say that the attacks just mount and mount. One wants to pray that on the other side of January 30th it's different, but it's hard to see, I mean, you know, how an insurgency is. They often go from strength to strength once they get on that kind of trail.
Yes, and they're on it now in a vengeance. No one has denied that they're growing in strength and in inventiveness of tactics and in boldness of tactics.
There it is. Very tough. We're going to look more at that next week, Jack. Really dive into what's going on with the war effort in Iraq. Thanks for being with us this week. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.